Chapter 3. Life's Signature in Ancient Rocks. Sedimentary rocks on the Arctic island of Spitsbergen formed 600 to 800 million years ago, well before the Cambrian explosion. These rocks contain no traces of animal life, but viewed under a microscope, they teem with tiny fossils of cyanobacteria, algae, and protozoans. More conspicuous are stromatolites, reef-like structures built by microbial communities. Most pervasive, however, are chemical signals imparted by microbial metabolisms. Such discoveries encourage us to explore much older beds for evidence of life's earliest evolution. Spitsbergen, an isolated and forbidding island halfway between Norway and the North Pole, is a starkly beautiful study in gray and white. The white is glacial ice that blankets most of the island. Gray, in various shades, stripes the rocks that rise from the ice in great cliffs, figure 3.1. Tundra wildflowers add a splash of color, but vegetation is sparse. Century-old willows on coastal lowlands stand only a few inches above the ground, overtopped even by pale tufts of reindeer moss. Higher in the mountains, only fairy rings of lichen, tiny but fiery orange, brighten the landscape. Seals and walruses sprawl languorously on grounded pack ice, and miniature reindeer graze on the miniature plants. Polar bears ply this coast as well, fat from alfresco dinners of seal, and curious about unusual sights like bright yellow tents pitched on a hill. Paleontologists sleep lightly in Spitsbergen. In the mountainous northeastern quarter of the island, valley glaciers, majestic rivers of ice that flow with inexorable power but almost imperceptible speed, have cut deep incisions into the landscape, so deep, in fact, that the Empire State Building placed on the ice would barely peak above a valley rim. "What am I doing here?" I asked myself as I crawled across a cliff top, unable to walk upright in the late afternoon gale. Like the "how did we get here?" query in Chapter 1, this question has a spectrum of possible answers. On that blustery afternoon in the Arctic, the question might well have been rephrased, "Why don't I work on tropical reefs?" Transient disgruntlement aside, my question has a literal answer. My field partner, University of Iowa geologist Keen Sweat, and I were logging a stratigraphic section through a thick succession of upper Proterozoic rocks exposed in the Spitsbergen cliffs. But once again, there is another answer, one that addresses why as well as what. The top of the sedimentary pile in this region contains early Cambrian fossils, much like those discovered along the Kotoikan River. Below extends a vast geological tome, more than 20,000 feet thick, written in a tropical seaway 800 to 600 million years ago. Consistent with their stratigraphic position beneath the oldest Cambrian strata, these Spitsbergen rocks contain no skeletons, no compressed carcasses, no tracks and trails, no evidence of animal life whatsoever. This doesn't necessarily mean that animals were absent when these beds were deposited, but any animals that did exist must have been tiny creatures that made little impact on accumulating sediments. Of course, the Tree of Life tells us that animals were preceded in time by other organisms, so we might search these rocks not for clams and brachiopods, but instead for the fossils of algae, protozoans, or even bacteria. Northeastern Spitsbergen is a nearly ideal place to ask paleontological questions about this earlier biology. That's what we're doing there, seeking insights into life and environments before the Cambrian explosion. Spitsbergen isn't the first place where Proterozoic fossils were found, and I certainly wasn't the first person to find them. That honor goes to Elzo Barghorn, the father of pre-Cambrian paleontology and my mentor at Harvard. In 1954, Barghorn and geologist Stanley Tyler reported the discovery of bacterial cells in nearly 2 billion-year-old rocks of the Gunflint Formation, Western Ontario. I was 3 years old and unaware that the seeds of my professional life were being planted. Spitsbergen is, however, where my own odyssey in Precambrian research took wing. In 1978, a freshly minted Ph.D. and vividly green assistant professor, I was casting about for a project that would establish my scientific independence from the great Barghorn. I had read about this inhospitable but potentially rewarding island in geological reports by Brian Harland of Cambridge University, and a hopeful letter to Harland, "Can you give me some pointers on working in Spitsbergen?" drew the best possible response. "Can you join us next summer?" Sure I could, little dreaming that this would redefine my research future. The following summer found me on a small Norwegian fishing boat, sailing with 3 Cambridge shipmates around the northern tip of the island. Some mornings the sea was like glass, mirroring the bright sun as well as the ice-covered peaks that lined the coast. Other days brought storms, and with them gray-green waves that tossed our boat and my stomach about like a toy. I knew little about sailing, less about wielding a pike to nudge ice out of our path, and absolutely nothing about what to do when whales approached our boat. Slow down and steer very carefully. I did know a little about paleontology, and, fortunately, promising rocks were abundant in the outcrops we studied. A minor frustration of Proterozoic paleontology is that the quarry is usually too small to be seen by eye. We can only collect rocks that experience tells us might yield fossils, ship them optimistically back to the lab, and then, months later, examine prepared specimens to learn of success or failure. I was lucky. The first sample I looked at turned out to be brimming with exceptionally preserved microfossils. Peering down my microscope, I felt like Howard Carter beaming his lamp into King Tut's tomb, privileged to see things, beautiful things, in the paper-thin slice of rock beneath my lens. I had a project, and over the next 7 years I would return repeatedly to this island, traveling by helicopter and snowshoe in a protracted effort to learn the paleobiological secrets of this remarkable place. I began by writing that the Spitsbergen rocks were deposited in a tropical seaway. How do we know this? And if we are correct, what are they doing on a mountaintop near the North Pole? Sedimentary geology is a vast repository of anecdote, lent structure by theory and experiment. A field geologist may notice the pattern of ripples that forms in sands along a lakeshore. Another will ask questions about these ripples in the laboratory, using a flow tank to determine the range of physical conditions under which they can form. Through repeated iterations of observation and experiment, an association grows between sediment pattern and the processes that govern its formation. In consequence, an experienced geologist can examine the pattern of bedding, structure, and texture in an ancient sandstone, and from it infer the set of environments and sedimentary processes in play when it formed. Interpreting the Spitsbergen rocks requires that we log the composition, thickness, and bedding features of successive layers. We must put hand lens to rock and eye to hand lens, scrunching our faces against the cliff to gain a magnified view of the ancient sediments. Every now and again, we wield a persuader, the steel-shafted hammer tucked into every geologist's belt, to gather fist-sized samples that can be shipped home. Back in the lab, field observations are supplemented by studies of thin sections, those paper-thin slices of rock, that reveal micron-scale features under the microscope. In the end, we associate each bed with a suite of characters that can be compared against features seen by other geologists in other rocks and in sediments accumulating today. Dialing into that collective pool of experience, we reconstruct the history of a small part of the world as it existed long ago. The backbone of the Spitsbergen succession is the Akademikerbreen group, a thick 7,000 feet stack of limestones and related rocks deposited near the edge of an ancient ocean, figure 3.1. Irregularly laminated dolomites mark the shoreward edge of deposition. The millimeter-thick layers, or laminae, in these rocks, figure 3.2, closely resemble structures formed today where microbial mats spread across tidal flats, trapping and binding fine sedimentary particles to form thin layers like delicate leaves of puff pastry. Prism-shaped cracks form a network of polygons in some beds. Most of us have seen similar features forming today where exposure to the sun causes wet muds to dry and crack. Ancient mud cracks formed the same way. Another curious feature helps to focus environmental interpretation. Here and there, sets of laminae several centimeters thick turn upward to form ridges, commonly fractured at their crests, figure 3.2. In cross-section, these features resemble wigwams, hence their easily remembered name, tepee structures. Tepees form today along warm, lime-rich coastlines in the zone just above high tide, where surface sediments are baked by the sun and only occasionally inundated by the sea. In this regime, the growth of carbonate and gypsum crystals builds up pressure in surface beds. Eventually, the beds buckle, forming the cracked ridges. The stacked beds of the Akademikerbreen group thus provide a record of time and environment. We just learned that some of the Akademikerbreen carbonates formed at the very edge of a coastal carbonate platform. Not surprisingly, these rocks occur in close association with beds deposited just seaward in the zone between high and low tides. Intertidal rocks are characterized by alternating sandy and muddy layers that record variations in wave and current energy, microbial mat layers without tepees, thicker beds formed by flowing tides whose angled sandy laminae impart a herringbone texture to the rock, and shallow channels cut by tides into underlying sediments. A comparable suite of features can be seen today in places like the Bahama Banks, where they form a clear sign of tidal flat sedimentation. Intertidal rocks, in turn, mingle with beds formed below the low tide mark in a coastal lagoon filled by lime muds, sands, and flakes stripped from the tidal flat during storms. The ancient Spitsbergen lagoon was protected by a shoal of oids, tiny spheres of concentrically laminated carbonate whose modern counterparts form where coastal waves repeatedly suspend particles in warm, lime-rich waters. Laminated domes and candelabrum-like structures up to several feet thick also punctuate the succession, patch reefs built by microbial communities. The first lesson learned by aspiring geologists is the present is the key to the past. Thus, modern sediments on the Bahama Banks help us to make sense of the Akademikerbreen group. The ability to link processes observable today with patterns that can be recognized in ancient rocks makes the geological elucidation of our planet's history possible. We must be careful, however, not to get carried away by the beauty of this premise. Uniformity of process does not boil down to plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The tectonic, sedimentary, and geochemical processes at work today may have been in force throughout Earth history, but that doesn't mean that the state of our planet's surface has been invariant through time. Ocean chemistry, geography, and climate have all changed through time in ways that have been decisive for the history of environments and life. Mies van der Rohe, the great Bauhaus architect, reputedly said that God is in the details. That's also where we'll find the keys to ancient states of the ocean and atmosphere. Take, for example, the oid shoals mentioned earlier. Today, marine oids have a maximum diameter of about 1 millimeter, the size of sand grains. The Akademikerbreen oids, in contrast, reach the size of garden peas. Evidently, the chemistry of the Spitsbergen Seaway wasn't quite like that of its closest modern analogues. It was more highly charged with calcium and carbonate ions, causing ooids to accrete faster and attain larger sizes than can be accomplished today. The giant ooids of Spitsbergen provide a first hint that the pre-Cambrian Earth was not simply our own world with the plants and animals stripped away, an observation that will be developed in later chapters into a principal theme of deep Earth history. For now, it is sufficient to remember that the uniformitarian principle, the present is the key to the past, is a statement about process, and one that should be viewed more as working hypothesis than universal truth in studies of the early Earth. Having outlined our reasons for interpreting the Spitsbergen rocks as products of tropical sedimentation, we should consider, at least briefly, why they sit today in refrigerated cliffs north of the Arctic Circle. The explanation is that plate tectonic processes transported them to their current position. The hypothesis that continents have drifted through time was proposed early in the 20th century by the German meteorologist Alfred Wegener, but it gained wide acceptance only in the 1960s and 1970s, when geophysical observations revealed how a seafloor conveyor belt, formed at oceanic ridges and destroyed beneath deep trenches, moves continents from place to place. Northeastern Spitsbergen moved poleward through the Paleozoic and Mesozoic eras, reaching its current latitude more than 100 million years ago. Then, with the opening of the Atlantic Ocean, this piece of real estate broke away from its closest geological relatives, now in Greenland, eventually to enter a deep freeze as the Great Pleistocene Ice Age began. The geographic repositioning of Spitsbergen is a bit of good fortune, leaving us with rocks that are beautifully exposed and little altered by surface weathering. An unlikely prospect had this landmass remained at low latitudes. By now, we know that the Spitsbergen rocks formed before the dawn of the Cambrian, in coastal environments at the edge of a tropical ocean. But was there life in that ocean, and did it leave a record in the Academicerbrene sediments? That's what we really want to know, and to find out, we must search for rocks likely to preserve delicate biological remains. Chert, also known as flint, is one such rock, an extraordinarily hard substance made up of tiny interlocking crystals of quartz, crystalline silica, or SiO2. Chert is hard enough to withstand the mechanical ravages of tectonic deformation and impermeable enough to shield its contents from corroding fluids. Encased in chert, then, sedimentary features, including biological features, can be preserved for the ages. Chert is common in tidal flat deposits of pre-Cambrian age, often occurring as black nodules within carbonate beds, figure 3.2. The nodules formed within the sediments, not on the seafloor, as demonstrated by lamination and other features of bedding that run unbroken through the silica and surrounding carbonate. What's more, the cherts display textural features normally associated with lime deposits. They contain the same ooids, microbial mats, and crystalline cement textures found in adjacent carbonate rocks. In many cases, the nodules formed soon after deposition, before burial initiated the compaction that bent encompassing sediments around them. Silica has no color of its own. The blackness of the nodules comes from included organic matter. Spitsbergen cherts contain abundant and remarkably well-preserved microfossils, exquisite tiny gems locked in a tomb of silica. Cherts in carbonates that formed above the high tide mark usually contain only a single type of microfossil, thick-walled tubes about 10 microns across that form a tightly woven fabric in the rock. A micron is extremely short, 1/1000th of a millimeter, or 40 millionths of an inch. An eyelash is more than 10 times as wide as these fossils. The tubes are interpreted as the extracellular sheaths of filamentous cyanobacteria, those hardy bacterial practitioners of green plant photosynthesis. The microbial weave indicates that these minute organisms formed the microbial mats whose signature is written in the wavy lamination of encompassing carbonates. Low-diversity cyanobacterial mats occur today along the shoreward edge of restricted embayments from the Florida Keys and the Bahamas to the Persian Gulf and the arid coast of Western Australia. On present-day tidal flats, microbial diversity increases toward the ocean, and Spitsbergen rocks show the same pattern. A series of mat-building cyanobacteria-like populations subdivided the ancient tidal gradient, forming discrete communities of mat-builders and dwellers, organisms that lived in but did not contribute to the formation of the mat, like clams that nestle among frame-building corals in modern reefs. Proterozoic microfossils have long been compared with living cyanobacteria, but how close is the comparison? Most blue-greens have simple shapes, and the morphological similarity between ancient and modern forms might mask deep physiological differences. Do we really mean to imply that cyanobacteria found today evolved before trilobites graced the oceans? One beautiful Spitsbergen population provides unusual insight into this issue. Polybessarus bipartitus consists of spheroidal cells 10 to 30 microns in diameter atop stalks made of extracellular secretions. Along the seaward edge of the ancient tidal flat, Polybessarus fossils are found as isolated individuals, but in more frequently exposed areas, they occur in dense populations that formed patchy crusts on the sediment surface. As my then-graduate student Julian Green, now at the University of South Carolina, first recognized, morphological variations in the preserved fossils allow us to reconstruct their life history. Cells settled on the tidal flat surface, and as they grew, began to secrete a series of extracellular envelopes. The stalks formed by successive envelopes enabled cells to maintain their position at the sediment-water interface, despite an influx of lime mud. Once individuals reached a certain size, they divided repeatedly, without intervening growth, to form small cells that dispersed and settled again on the sediment surface, beginning the cycle again. That's a lot to know about a Precambrian microfossil, enough for us to seek meaningful comparisons with living organisms. Frustratingly, published compendiums of cyanobacterial biology do not describe living populations with the suite of characters observed in the Spitsbergen fossils. But we knew something else about our microfossils. They lived along a tidal flat that bordered a subtropical to tropical seaway where carbonate sediments accumulated. Armed with this knowledge, I traveled with my friend, academic neighbor at Boston University, and cyanobacteria guru Steve Golubich to the closest modern environmental analog we could identify, the Bahama Banks. Science occasionally compensates those who summer in Spitsbergen. There, on the lonely western edge of Andros Island, we found small black crusts dotting a tidal flat of lime mud laced with cyanobacterial mats. The crusts formed in the upper part of the intertidal zone, built by small spheroidal cyanobacteria that secreted extracellular sheaths elongated in the downward direction. That's right. Here, in a place predicted by Proterozoic rocks, we found the modern counterpart we sought, living but hitherto undescribed cyanobacteria whose morphology, life cycle, and environmental distribution match the ancient Polybessarus bipartitus. The Spitsbergen example isn't an isolated instance of good luck. Steve's former graduate student Asad Al-Thukair, now at King Faisal University in Saudi Arabia, has discovered a half-dozen new species of cyanobacteria that bore into and live within oid grains. Nearly all have exact fossil counterparts in silicified proterozoic oids of Spitsbergen and eastern Greenland. Because these cyanobacteria display stereotyped patterns of boring, even behavior can be included in the list of features shared by living and fossil populations. Steve and Montreal University's Hans Hoffmann have drawn equally fine-scale ancient-modern comparisons between mat-building cyanobacteria found today on arid tidal flats and fossils that lived in comparable environments 2 billion years ago. Collectively, these discoveries put some teeth into the old saw that many Proterozoic fossils look like cyanobacteria. Because habitat range is a direct function of physiology, the close environmental similarity between ancient and living cyanobacteria suggests that the microorganisms distributed across Spitsbergen and other Proterozoic tidal flats were essentially modern in morphology, life cycle, and physiology. Many of the cyanobacteria we see today are indeed survivors from the ancient Earth. Cyanobacteria are common today in coastal habitats where very salty water or other environmental challenges restrict invasion by animals. By coincidence, the chert nodules in Proterozoic carbonates also center on coastal environments where silica was precipitated much like salt from evaporating seawater. Thus, Chert's paleontological lantern shines most brightly on just those environments where cyanobacteria have always thrived. Cyanobacteria do not live alone on modern tidal flats, however. Mat communities contain a host of other organisms, especially bacteria. Why don't we see this greater microbial diversity in chert nodules? Tidal flats are harsh environments. At low tide, their inhabitants must tolerate the desiccating glare of a blazing sun. Salty water provides an osmotic trial when the weather is dry. Fresh water does the same during storms. Cyanobacteria respond to these challenges by secreting an extracellular envelope that protects the cells inside. That envelope is of particular importance to paleontologists because, unlike the cells within, it resists bacterial decay after death. Cyanobacteria, then, have the microbial equivalent of a clamshell, and in tidal flat cyanobacteria, this feature is especially well-developed. While other bacteria live on tidal flats, most lack preservable walls or envelopes, and to make matters worse, they are tiny and have simple shapes that frustrate biological interpretation. The very fact that preserved fossils show evidence of post-mortem decay means that heterotrophic bacteria must have lived in tidal flat environments. As discussed later, geochemical signatures enable us to identify at least a few of these populations, but we must face the fact that what we see preserved in thin sections of chert, while extraordinary, represents only a limited sampling of the microorganisms that lived along the Proterozoic shoreline. Fortunately, the sample preserved best is one well worth understanding. Cyanobacteria are the working-class heroes of the pre-Cambrian Earth, the main primary producers in early oceans, and the source of the oxygen that transformed terrestrial environments. We know a great deal about living cyanobacteria, including their phylogenetic relationships. Add the good fortune that they are easily preserved and include species that can be recognized by form alone, and it becomes clear that cyanobacteria make an excellent flagship for paleontological studies of early life. Although most fossils in the Spitsbergen cherts are undoubted or probable cyanobacteria, rare specimens of relatively large microfossils, greater than 100 microns, some shaped like miniature vases, and others studded with spines, provide tantalizing glimpses of a different biology. These fossils are limited to sediments that washed into tidal channels from offshore, suggesting that if we continue our environmental transect seaward, we might discover a diversity of Proterozoic life barely hinted at by the cherts. During our field expeditions, I collected many samples of black shales that accumulated in quiet subtidal environments beyond the Ooid Shoal. Like the cherts, these shales are black because they contain organic matter. Mesmerized by the chert biotas, I didn't do much with our shale samples, but when Nick Butterfield, now, like Harland, at Cambridge University, came on board as a graduate student, I suggested that he take a look at them to get some first-hand experience with Precambrian rocks. Microscopic fossils are common in shales of all ages, packed cheek by jowl with clay minerals that inhibit decay. The mineral fabric of these rocks can be dissolved in strong acid, leaving organic remains to be mounted on glass slides and studied by optical or electron microscope. Conventional preparations of Spitsbergen shales yield conventional fossils, but Nick developed a set of unconventional procedures that enabled him to identify and gently free fragile remains. His painstaking work revealed a paleontological treasure trove. Plenty of cyanobacteria occur in these shales. Neither then nor now are these microbes limited to tidal flats. But the Spitsbergen shales also contain diverse fossils of eukaryotic organisms, recognizable by their distinctive shapes. The vase-shaped fossils that washed onto the tidal flat are there, as are the large cells decked with spines. More exciting, however, the shales contain multicellular algae, the remains of small seaweeds that formed lawns on the shallow seafloor. Some of these fossils closely resemble green algae that can still be seen today, Plate 2E. Others, however, have no close modern counterparts. Like trilobites and dinosaurs, they are extinct, consigned by selection or catastrophe to the dustbin of natural history. The Spitsbergen fossils are abundant and beautifully preserved. They are distributed over a range of sedimentary environments, and they include both prokaryotes and eukaryotes. On the other hand, they occur only in limited horizons of black chert and shale. The true ubiquity and diversity of late Proterozoic life is revealed by other biological indicators, most conspicuously stromatolites, the wavy laminated, domed, and candelabrum-like structures seen in academic herbane rocks, Figure 3.3. Stromatolites are the predominant features of carbonate rocks formed in Precambrian oceans. Stromatolitic buildups are uncommon today, but examples from places like the Bahama Banks and especially remote Shark Bay in Western Australia show how they form. Communities of microorganisms spread across sediment surfaces, weaving together to form coherent mats. Cyanobacteria, and sometimes algae, at the mat surface trap and bind fine particles supplied by waves and currents. As a veneer of mud or sand accumulates, these populations grow upward, reestablishing the mat at the sediment surface. Deeper in the mat, bacteria consume dead cells, changing local chemistry in a way that causes carbonate crystals to form. The processes of colonization, trapping and binding, and carbonate precipitation are discontinuous but endlessly repetitive, with the result that fine layers of limestone accrete one atop another. Stromatolites can be planar, domal, conical, or cylindrical. Each one records a history of microbial growth on the ancient seafloor. Chert nodules in the wavy laminated carbonates of Spitsbergen tidal flats preserve a direct record of mat-building microorganisms, and in one locality, the cyanobacterial architects of an offshore stromatolitic reef were preserved by fine carbonate cements that encrusted individual filaments. Most Spitsbergen stromatolites, however, contain no microfossils, and so must be interpreted as biological features by invoking the association between sedimentary pattern and microbiological process outlined in the preceding paragraph. That's not such a bad practice in younger Proterozoic successions like Spitsbergen, but as we shall see, assumptions about stromatolite formation become more contentious as we descend deeper into the past. In general, then, stromatolites provide a sedimentary proxy record of microbial communities, revealing, like Friday's footprints in the sand, the presence but not the character of their makers. Still, this information is helpful, for it shows that 600 to 800 million years ago, microorganisms colonized nearly every available surface on the Spitsbergen seafloor, from tidal flats to the open ocean. Like stromatolites, organic matter is much more widely distributed than microfossils in Academicherbrene rocks. Roger Summons, an Australian geochemist now at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has shown that the organic matter in Proterozoic sedimentary beds includes biomarkers, biological molecules of known origin that are preserved in and can be extracted from the rock. These molecules consist mainly of lipids that have survived a gauntlet of bacterial decay. Sadly, nitrogen and phosphorus-rich molecules like DNA have a vanishingly small likelihood of preservation in very old rocks. To date, the search for biomarkers in Spitsbergen rocks has not been notably successful, but elsewhere, especially in shales of similar age exposed deep within the Grand Canyon, abundant and diverse biomarker molecules preserve molecular signatures of archaeans, bacteria, protozoans, and algae, most of which have left no recognizable microfossils. Biology is encrypted in the Spitsbergen rocks in one additional, even more generalized way. Individual microorganisms are tiny, but their collective physiological effect can be strong enough to influence the chemical composition of the ocean. As a prime example, photosynthetic organisms influence the isotopic composition of carbonate minerals and organic matter deposited beneath the sea. Isotopes provide our second set of Jacob Marley facts. The metabolic diversity of bacteria was the first. We have to come to grips with this bit of chemistry because isotopes will allow us to track aspects of metabolic evolution through time. Moreover, as we'll see in subsequent chapters, isotopes provide a key to understanding the interplay between life and environmental change through our planet's history. Carbon atoms come in three varieties, distinguished by molecular weight. About 99% of all carbon is in the form of carbon-12, meaning that it contains 6 protons and 6 neutrons, for a total molecular weight of 12. Electrons have negligible mass. Most of the remaining 1% consists of carbon-13, its extra neutron contributing to a molecular weight of 13. There is also a bit of carbon-14, 2 extra neutrons, but this form is radioactive and decays to nitrogen on a timescale of millennia. Thus, carbon-14 doesn't figure in discussions of very old rocks. Because of their differing molecular weights, these isotopes behave differently in some chemical reactions. Notably, when photosynthetic organisms take up carbon dioxide to form organic molecules, CO2 containing the lighter variety, carbon-12 is incorporated more readily than CO2 that contains carbon-13. In consequence, the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 in organic matter made by photosynthesis will be distinctly different from that of carbonate minerals formed in the same environment, a quantitative difference known as fractionation, figure 3.4. The difference is not large, about 25 to 30 parts per thousand, but it can easily be detected by geochemists armed with mass spectrometers. And this fractionation is preserved in sediments, providing us with a geochemical probe for ancient photosynthesis. Organisms like ourselves that eat plants, algae, cyanobacteria, or other photosynthetic bacteria do not impart much additional fractionation in the process. In the Spitsbergen rocks, the ratios of carbon isotopes in carbonates and organic matter consistently differ by about 28 parts per thousand, so photosynthesis fueled ecosystems in late Proterozoic oceans, just as it does today. Chemistry also provides a paleobiological probe for sulfate-reducing bacteria. As noted in Chapter 2, sulfate reducers play a key role in completing the marine carbon cycle, using sulfate ions, SO4-2-, to respire organic molecules. The sulfate is converted to hydrogen sulfide, H2S, that may combine with iron to enter the sedimentary record as pyrite, FeS2, the fool's gold sold in rock shops. Biological sulfate reduction shows a chemical preference for sulfur-32, 16 protons and 16 neutrons, over the heavier isotope sulfur-34, 2 extra neutrons, resulting in sedimentary pyrite that is enriched in sulfur-32 relative to gypsum formed from the same water body. Spitsbergen rocks indicate that the essential biological components of the sulfur cycle, like those of the carbon cycle, were in place when the gray rocks of this Arctic island accumulated. As observed on first sighting, the frozen Proterozoic rocks of Spitsbergen contained no bones, shells, or fossil trackways, nothing that would reward the casual collector, or Darwin, on a weekend fossil hunt. But the apparent lack of fossils is deceptive. Shells simply provide the wrong search image for pre-Cambrian paleontology. All of the carbonate minerals and organic carbon in the thick Spitsbergen succession bear the isotopic imprint of photosynthesis, and sulfur-containing minerals similarly preserve a metabolic signature of sulfate-reducing bacteria. Stromatolites document the ubiquity of microbial communities on the seafloor, while microfossils record aspects of biological diversity on the seafloor as well as in the water column. When we look carefully, then, the fingerprints of biology are all over the Proterozoic rocks of Spitsbergen. The geological record does contain a record of early evolution that can be used to trim the tree of life. Our experience in Spitsbergen tells us how to approach ancient rocks and what to look for. But at 800 million years, the oldest beds on this desolate island are still relatively young. What happens when we apply these lessons to the bottom of the pile?